Thank you. Firstly, I'd like to thank the organizers of this conference. Thank you very much. And thank my fellow panelists. I feel really privileged to be speaking with you. So I'm going to just pick up actually where Stephen, and I didn't, when I first thought about this, I thought, okay, this isn't going to flow at all, but it's actually flowing quite well. So I'll pick up where Stephen left off in terms of the anti-war movement and the anti-globalization movement, and the sort of the shortcomings of the movement, as well as how the movement's done very well. So, and my main topic that I will be speaking on will be racism. So the state of racism in Canada is appalling, in my opinion. Under a very thin veneer of multiculturalism that the state likes to have people of this country imagine is a structuralized racism that is directed from the state. If we take the approach of looking at racism on a local level, and local, I'm from British Columbia, so that's my local. In British Columbia, we'll see blatant racist attacks on Aboriginal people of this province with Gordon Campbell's treaty referendum. This referendum is asking the people of BC to decide whether provincial government should negotiate treaties with Aboriginal peoples. So you can see that on that level, the level of racism is really disgusting. On a national level, the federal Liberals, after September 11th, rushed through very strict racist immigration laws. Well before September 11th, the Citizenship and Immigration Minister Eleanor Caplan was pushing through Bill C-11. Now, this law greatly restricts the rights of refugee claimants. Bill C-11 was rushed through the Senate, and the immigrants who have spent, under this law, immigrants who've spent time in 14 designated high-risk countries, which are, surprisingly or unsurprisingly, all in the third world, are subject to extraordinary investigation at the borders. And after September 11th, scapegoating of third world immigrants already in place and instigated by the federal Liberal government had been given a green light. So it's not that this all happened post September 11th, but there was a buildup towards having these immigration laws. And this immigration law had been, they've been trying to get it through for years. And September 11th was like, they had the ultimate excuse to get through this immigration law. So on the international level, and of course there's the war on terrorism, which is in fact starting to almost look like a war on brown people, just considering that they're wanting to extend the war into Iraq. So people of color are being painted implicitly as a disloyal, treacherous, and for the safety of average Canadians, which are average white Canadians. The bulk of my talk is going to concentrate on the racist backlash that's occurring, the unspoken victims of the war. So the backlash has been encouraged by the media and politicians alike. Just one example of the backlash, October 17th, the Vancouver Sun, which is one of our local papers, had this headline, Islam's political choice, : civilization or barbarism. So that is an example of what racism on that level looks like. That says so many things. It's talking about nationalism, and there's a crisis going on. But on the other hand, the size of the protests against the war and the speed with which they were built were quite impressive. They brought together many people who were involved in anti-war and peace movements of the past, with the new generation of young people who were determined to stop the world from being destroyed. So the young anti-capitalist movement, which has grown over the past 2.5 years, was a breathing life into the anti-war movement. It was almost like CPR for the anti-war movement. So the anti-capitalist movement has done a lot to make many activists from different backgrounds to come together. The most memorable slogan from Seattle was, Teamsters and Turtles Together at Last. Now, this was a major victory for the left, having different parts of the left come together, and different parts of the left that actually were, had a lot of animosity. So for that to happen was quite amazing. And so the anti-globalization movement brought together activists from all over the globe, but with different perspectives. And all these victories have been accumulated over a very short period of time. If you think 2.5 years, that's not a very long time at all. But that's the way I like to think about it. But I will focus on the shortfall of the same movement, and this talk is meant to be a critical talk, not an attack on the movement that I have the great joy of being a part of. So the fast pace of the movement often leads with there's a lot of problematic issues that come about. But because of the pace of the movement, a lot of the issues that need to be dealt with slide. This creates tension between different communities of activists. For example, activists lose themselves in organizing against the neoliberal premiers like Gordon Campbell, or they prepare to go to the next summit. However, issues like racism come up, and activists think that talking about that within the coalitions is sometimes a deterrent to the movement itself to have a discussion about these problems because there's a talk of solidarity. Often, this is because often what this leads to is activists of color are left abandoned to deal with racism in the movement by themselves. Thus, the burden of rectifying the problem is left to the activists of color. So, the people that are being faced with the problem are the ones that are left to deal with the problem. The anti-globalization movement is not immune from the racist rhetoric that exists in society, and I think that point needs to be very, very clear. Just because we're in the movement doesn't mean that we are exempt from what goes on in the rest of society. Soon after the protests, WTO protest in Seattle in 1999, there were critiques published about racism and the then budding movement. There was an essay by Elizabeth Martinez called "Where Was the Color in Seattle?" that addressed these issues, and I'll do a little quote from it just to give you a bit of a historical perspective and where the movement was at. People of color had reason to expect the protest to be white. Robert, I can't pronounce his last name, director of the Seattle Centro de la Raza, told me that in the massive local press coverage before the WTO meeting, not a single person of color appeared as a spokesperson for the opposition. Day after day, you only saw white people in the news. The publicity was a real deterrent to people of color. I think some of the unions and church groups should have had representatives of color to encourage people of color to come and participate. So this problem has existed with the budding of the movement. So what I'm going to try to focus on now is activists of color that are involved in the anti-war movement. So the question, where are all the activists of color, is related to a lot of different topics. But I want to address the racism that activists of color face in some cases where racism that activists of color face with, I mean, it's on a double level. There's racism that you face from everyone else because you're an activist of color, from all of society because you're a person of color that's a rabble rouser. And then there's racism that people feel from within the movement. So there's two different strands. So I'm just going to talk about how the state also uses those divisions as well. The police officers in Washington, D.C. during the IMF protests of 2000 were black. And this was a conscious decision on part of the ruling class because the protesters were predominantly white. So during this particular protest, the ruling class was blatantly playing a race card. Racism is inherent to the ideology of the police. The ruling class attempts to use the divide and conquer mentality in society against the anti-capitalist, anti-war movements. As the crisis in world capitalism deepens, it will become more important to the ruling class that workers adopt a racist and nationalist ideas, because as capitalist production becomes more integrated, it's even more necessary to bosses that workers in different parts of the world that are wearing the same overalls and doing the same jobs do not identify with each other, but have a spurious national interest. So racist police activity reinforces the notion of uniform national identity. Last summer, during the G8 protests in Genoa, a white protester was killed. So everyone knows about that. Most left-wing media broadly publicized this fact that Carlo Giuliani was the first martyr and victim of the movement against globalization. So this is a lot of problems come out when you're talking about this. Just like an example of some of the headlines that were on some of the left-wing press, Corporate Watch. It's a website, and the headline was Carlo Giuliani, his death, July 19th, marks a milestone for the anti-globalization movement. It's as significant as a battle in Seattle. So there's a racist assumption there that, and people of color were really offended by statements like that. That it assumes that you have to be white in order to be a legitimate activist, because hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the third world countries have died against protesting the alphabet soup of globalization. So there's, you know, all these people have died, but then, you know, one white guy dies, and, you know, not that I'm saying that's okay, but one white guy dies, and all of a sudden, he's all over every type of press, left-wing and right-wing. So, you know, there's problems there. There's a lot of problems that need to be addressed. So since the events of September 11th, this trend has become even more tedious. The state has attempted time and time again to whip up nationalist and racist sentiments. The ruling class has attempted to scapegoat brown people for the world's problems. They point to conflicts in Asia between India and Pakistan, in the Middle East, the new Intifada, and of course Muslims across the board for terrorism. And, you know, by pointing to all these conflicts, they're painting brown people as being a very violent people that can't get along with each other. So they're scapegoating of brown people for the violence that, and, you know, without taking any blame for themselves, they're saying, well, you know, they just like to fight. The cracks that existed in the anti-globalization movement that I've actually mentioned before with Seattle, with you know, the IMF, have been exposed since September 11th. These cracks came into plain view when certain coalitions refused to adopt slogans like "Islam is not the enemy," or you know, some sort of similar sentiments. And it seemed like the rhetoric on the left was supporting attitudes. However, when it came down to taking a position, going out on the streets, and doing something, it didn't happen. At least that's my experience. So in Victoria, which is where I'm from, what happened with our coalition was we adopted a slogan, "Islam is not the enemy, war is not the answer." But when it came down to it, we dropped the "Islam is not the enemy." So we came up with "A war is not the answer," which I think with the high state of politics today and a high level of politics within our movement, that's not a very clear analysis. You know, war is not the answer. That, you know, everyone can say war is not the answer, but a lot of people are. And so this stance was offensive to people of color, in Victoria especially. The anti-war movement's superficial position towards racist nature of the war served to marginalize and alienate people of color. Thus, many people of color felt that they were left to fend for themselves. So the cracks that existed after Seattle were full-grown for some people, and they saw the cracks in the movement. In Victoria, the issue of war and racism was under intense debate for some time. In this case, there was people of color who were arguing that Islam is in fact the enemy. So this actually adds a different dynamic into the debate. So, I mean, it poses a really interesting problem. And so, I mean, the question is, what is the left supposed to do when a person of color is advocating an argument that it seems to work against what they seem to be reasonable? So some people wanted to take on the slogan, but when there's, you know, a person of color advocating it, it's hard for white people to see what, you know, who to believe. So, I mean, it's a tough problem, and I think this was a test. It was a big test for us. I think this was So it's really important to remember that every person that comes to coalitions comes with their own agendas, and people of color aren't exempt from this as well. So that's something that, you know, like, there's divisions, and we're not just one big homogenous group. There's divisions, and that's, but I mean, it's responsibility of all the left to take on arguments and to think for themselves around issues and that may not affect them directly, but it is a responsibility that exists. And the battle for interpretation will always exist, and it's crucial that activists do not get pulled away from debates that exist, and that's what ended up happening in Victoria. The whole sentiment around race and war was dropped officially by the coalition. A lot of, I mean, the way things were shaped, the interpretation, was strange because, you know, people were just like, well, they all left, you know, all the activists of color, they just didn't want to stay anymore. But what did they do? Activists of color fled to the cultural associations to organize against the war. They fled to their own communities because the white community did not defend them. They did not defend them against the war. They did not take a position against the war. That means they did not defend them against the war. So what did they do? I mean, the only option they had left was to go and organize for themselves. So this is a problem, I think. Racism within the left is always clothed behind an indignant position of I'm progressive, I can't be racist. Or I'm progressive, I can't be homophobic. I'm progressive, I can't be sexist, you know. But there is an explanation for a lot of this. And Karl Marx said that, and he explained this, the contradiction of discrimination and people that want to change the society as people have the muck of ages that follow them around. And this muck can't be shaken off in the first few years of the movement. It should be, but it can't. And that muck exists when we're bombarded by, you know, Vancouver Sun saying that Islam has a political choice between civilization and barbarism. So the most important thing for white activists to do is show compassion, think for themselves, and admit to charges of racism rather than write them off as melodramatic or to say, well, you're into identity politics and that's why you're accusing me of racism. You know, that's not the way, you know, there are legitimate charges. So it's important to have a solid analysis around racism. And so you can advocate anti-racism confidently, and I think that's like you have to shift arguments when an assault comes from the ruling class, when an assault comes onto people, the movement has to shift with that assault. And so if there's an assault on people of color, which there was, the movement didn't shift enough to you know, fight it back, at least in my opinion. So the slogan "A Better World Is Coming" is, you know, which is a slogan that's been taken on by a lot of different groups. It's a beautiful slogan. It's an idealistic slogan. However, the better world will not be led by labor leaders being disrespectful of Aboriginal people, as was the case on February 23rd in BC, which is our big major rally against Gordon Campbell. So the BC Federation of Labor, they didn't challenge the racist comments that were made by rank and file unionists during the rally, even when Aboriginal community asked for a formal apology. And, you know, where was the movement then? You know, where were white people? Where were people to defend Aboriginal people? The fact is, you know, they were asked to march in front of the people. If you're asking Aboriginal people to march in front of you don't go and disrespect them. You don't. That's fucked up. Excuse my language. So what they did was they proceeded to take their union banners, run up in front of the elders, and have their big giant union banner in front of Aboriginal elders. And you know, I think we're talking about strategizing. This to me, the best way of strategizing against that is to fucking expose what the labor leaders are doing, expose what was happening, and that way it's actually going to give confidence to people to fight it. You know, if people don't know what's happening, and it's just not going to happen. So the issues that I've discussed can't be taken with a grain of salt. It's important for all people to work together in order to get anywhere in our fight against capitalism. There is no room for racist behavior to continue. I think that these problems that are not addressed, if these problems aren't addressed soon, activists of color will start to leave coalitions, as they have been doing in Victoria. The way that I suggest that we take on the issue of racism in coalition work, in community work, is by creating a culture of debate, and that's really important. Debate, dissent, and atmosphere where people of color will feel comfortable to voice these debates and dissent. So during the last upsurge of the 1960s, the movement was unable to overcome these problems. Thus, the movement split into identity politics. That cannot happen. The stakes are much higher. Our movement can't afford to succumb to splitting on terms. I mean, the way we're going to defeat capitalism is by mass organizing, and we can't succumb to having to fragment into organizing on the basis of identity. The movement today is facing a different version of the same problem in terms of identity politics. Many people of color approach white activists in a hostile manner when they are not included in this. When they're not included. So what happens is there's necessary tension that comes up amongst both groups, but that tension needs to be dealt with when people of color approach a coalition in a hostile manner. It creates tension, but that tension is always swept under the rug. So it means we have to confront each other. It means that we have to And through that confrontation, we'll succeed in creating a better world. So today's form of identity politics is almost like a survival skill. It's not like the 1960s. There's a different wave of identity politics. And diasporic communities of color are attempting to bond together closer than ever to form a tight-knit group for self-preservation against racism everywhere. And that is a human response to September 11th. But, you know, we've seen what happened in the 60s. We saw what happened. There wasn't a mass movement against capitalism, you know, which exists today. So I think that race or any other identity can't be the only basis of organizing against a system of oppression, even though it's a really human response to go and do that. Although these problems do seem to be impossible to disentangle, I do feel like there is hope. It is important to remember that we must stop fragmentation that occurs within the movement. Sometimes that means that the meeting may go on longer. You know, you might not have a chance for a beer after the meeting, but you know, if the meeting goes longer, so be it. And sometimes that means that we're going to have to confront people for sometimes careless remarks that they don't think about, or little jokes that they don't think about. The left must practice what we preach, or the result will be fragmentation, which will weaken the movement against capitalism. It is exactly this movement against capitalism, that I feel will help raise the awareness of oppression that exists in society, as well as finding ways of ending that oppression. The anti-capitalist movement through struggle reveals and generalizes the totality of social relations. I feel that in order to fight oppression that exists in society, we must build a united anti-capitalist movement at the same time as engaging with debates within the movement.